Imagine standing on a factory floor, just watching a massive robotic arm thread this microscopic wire into a circuit board.
It's incredible to see in person, honestly.
Yeah, but now imagine if that arm misses its mark by like half a millimeter. It just completely destroys the component.
Right. And if it does that 10 times an hour, you're talking about the factory losing millions of dollars.
Exactly. Or, you know, think of a three-story stamping press forming steel car doors. If the timing is off by just a fraction of a second, the whole machine literally tears itself apart.
Yeah, it's violent.
So today we are taking a deep dive into the invisible mechanical giants that make literally everything in your life. And honestly, the stakes for building these machines have just never been higher.
No, they really haven't. And the sheer scale of this sector is almost difficult to comprehend until you look at the raw data.
Oh, the numbers are wild.
Right. I mean, according to Grandview Research, if you look at their projections for 2026, the global machine tools market is hitting $117.2 billion.
Wow.
And that hardware is deeply intertwined with a global smart manufacturing market that has swelled to over $410 billion.
Yeah.
So we are talking about $500 trillion resting entirely on how well these machines are engineered.
Which means designing them is not just about, you know, a lone inventor sketching on a drafting table anymore.
Definitely not.
Right. We're looking at a massive stack of engineering guides, industry trend reports, and global regulatory standards today. The whole mission for this deep dive is to shortcut your path to understanding how modern industrial equipment is actually designed.
Because it's a huge shift.
It is. We are moving from basic physics and welded steel all the way up to digital twins and artificial intelligence. Because building a machine today is just an incredibly high-stakes systems engineering problem. So, I mean, let's unpack this. What actually separates designing an industrial machine from, say, designing a consumer vehicle or a household appliance?
Well, industrial machinery design is this fascinating discipline because it sits in this highly pressurized space. It's between general mechanical engineering and strict, uncompromising production logic.
Okay, so it's not just about making parts move.
Right. I mean, a general mechanical engineer can design an assembly that moves. But industrial machinery is entirely focused on predictable performance in really aggressive environments.
It's like they never stop running.
Exactly.
Yeah.
These machines have defined relentless duty cycles. They are expected to run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, sometimes for decades at a time.
That's exhausting just to think about.
Yeah, and because of that, they have uncompromising maintainability targets, integrated safety functions, and really rigorous compliance obligations.
So, as I was reading the breakdown of all these subsystems and the engineering guides, I was trying to picture how they all fit together, you know? And to me, it feels a lot like the human body.
Oh, that's an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah, like the structural frame. The welded steel or cast iron is obviously the skeleton, it holds everything up.
Right.
But then you have the drive systems and the hydraulics. Would that be like the muscle?
You're definitely on the right track there. Hydraulics provide that raw brute force lifting power. Meanwhile, pneumatic systems act a bit more like fast twitch muscles, giving you that quick repetitive speed.
Okay, makes sense.
And then, just to complete your analogy, you have the electrical and control systems. So the PLCs, the programmable logic controllers, and all the sensors, they act as the nervous system.
Taking in all the information.
Exactly. They're constantly reading the environment and telling the muscles exactly when and how to fire.
But just like a body, everything has to work together perfectly. And what the sources emphasize heavily is that the actual day-to-day job of an engineer is basically just managing brutal trade-offs between those systems.
Oh, absolutely. You pull one lever and another one moves. That is just the reality of the job. Every single design choice is a compromise.
Give me an example of that.
But let's look at the muscle of the power transmission. An engineer has to choose between, say, a belt drive and a gear train.
Okay.
Now, a belt drive is much quieter and it's vastly cheaper to install and replace. But,
There's always a but.
right. But if your application requires high torque precision with zero backlash, meaning absolutely no slip or mechanical play when it changes direction, a rubber belt simply cannot deliver that.
Because it stretches.
Exactly. So you are forced to use the rigidity of a gear train, even though it costs way more, requires complex lubrication, and adds a ton of weight.
Yeah, and there's another classic trade-off mentioned in the reading too, environmental protection versus thermal management.
That's a huge one.
Right. So if you have a highly sensitive control system, your nervous system, you obviously want to protect it from all the metal shavings and moisture flying around the factory floor. So you design a perfectly sealed, highly compact metal enclosure.
Which seems like the smart thing to do. But by solving your contamination problem, you have instantly created a massive thermal density problem.
Because of the heat.
Yeah. Those electronic components generate a lot of heat. And in a perfectly sealed box, that heat literally has nowhere to go. You will fry your own nervous system.
Which is bad.
Very bad. So now the engineer has to carve out space and budget for heat sinks, coolant channels, or active thermal dissipation.
It really is a constant balancing act. But you can't just throw all these organs into a metal box and hope the machine works. The engineering guides outline a very specific six-step genesis to get these machines onto the factory floor, right?
Yes, the six steps really provide the discipline for the whole process. It always begins with requirements.
Mean what? Exactly.
Defining the throughput, the exact physical tolerances, and the environment it's going to live in. Then comes step two, conceptual design, where engineers weigh all those architectural trade-offs we just talked about.
You're right. Belt versus gear, that kind of thing.
Exactly. Step three is detailed engineering. That's building the parametric CAD models and sizing every single bearing and motor. Step four is prototyping and testing. Step five is regulatory compliance.
Lots of paperwork there, I imagine.
A mountain of it. And finally, step six is production scaling, where you standardize the blueprints so the machine can actually be built repeatedly and profitably.
Honestly, it sounds incredibly orderly when you list it out like that. But then the guides dive into the brutal physics that can tear a machine apart during step four, the testing phase.
Yes.
Specifically, they talk about the difference between static load and dynamic fatigue. Because it's one thing for a machine to just sit there holding a heavyweight. It's an entirely different beast when it starts moving.
That distinction right there is where machines live or die. Most production assets experience severe vibration, rapid acceleration, shock impacts, and thermal gradients.
Indeed. Thermal gradients, what's that?
It's when one side of the machine is expanding from heat while the other side is cool. It twists the metal. Designing a steel frame to survive one massive static peak load is relatively simple. But surviving millions of dynamic cycles.
That's the hard part.
Yeah. Think about taking a metal paperclip and just bending it back and forth.
Right.
It doesn't break the first time, right?
Yeah.
But the stress concentrates at the bend, creates this microscopic crack, and eventually snaps.
So that's fatigue.
That is fatigue. And in a machine, fatigue zeroes in on any tiny stress concentration, like a sharp corner or an imperfect weld joint.
And to fight this invisible threat, the industry relies heavily on FEA, finite element analysis. For you listening, FEA is basically this godlike simulation software that lets an engineer visualize exactly where the stress is concentrating inside a 3D model, right?
Yeah, it highlights the weak points in bright red before they ever cut a piece of steel.
Okay, but I have to stop you here and challenge this a bit.
Go ahead.
If we have this incredible simulation software that shows us the weak points, why do I still see videos online of brand new factory equipment just shaking itself to pieces under a heavy load?
Well, what's fascinating here is that FEA is merely a mathematical tool.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a crystal ball. It relies entirely on the boundary conditions entered by the human.
Boundary conditions?
Yeah, the mathematical rules you tell the computer about how the real world behaves.
Oh, I see.
For instance, if you tell the software that your machine's base is bolted to an infinitely rigid, perfectly flat concrete floor, the software calculates the stress based on that fantasy.
The factory floors aren't perfect.
Not at all. In reality, factory floors are uneven, concrete flexes under a heavy load, and steel bolts actually stretch.
Yeah.
If an engineer makes bad assumptions about those boundary conditions, the software just produces a beautiful, colorful graphic that is completely detached from reality.
Garbage in, garbage out.
Exactly. A flawless simulation with bad assumptions equals a real-world collapse.
Wow. So the computer only knows the context you give it. And what you give it is heavily dependent on where this machine is going to live.
Yeah.
Which brings us to a massive shift in our source material.
The environmental context.
Right. Surviving physics is really only half the battle.
Yeah.
The sector completely dictates the architecture. Like, let's look at food and beverage processing. A machine that works perfectly in a car factory would be completely illegal in a dairy plant.
Absolutely. In food and beverage, hygiene overrides almost everything else. A machine has to be built with highly specific grades of stainless steel to survive harsh, acidic chemical washdowns.
And no sharp corners.
Right. It's fundamentally about geometry.
Yeah.
Engineers have to eliminate these dead zones where a single crumb or drop of liquid could get trapped and breed bacteria. Every horizontal surface has to be perfectly sloped for drainage.
So they can wash it easily.
Exactly. They design for clean-in-place practices, meaning the machine can be entirely sterilized without being taken apart by a technician.
Now contrast that with mining and heavy extraction.
Oh, totally different world.
Completely. You are dealing with environments ranging from negative 50 to positive 50 degrees Celsius, according to the data from ABB.
Mm.
You have highly abrasive rock dust and constant brutal shock.
Right. A mining machine prioritizes rugged, heavy, easily repairable components. You don't care about lightweight efficiency. You just care about not breaking down in a remote pit.
And then you pivot over to pharmaceuticals, which introduces an entirely different universe of rigor.
Oh, pharma is incredibly strict. It's governed by GMP, good manufacturing practice, and really strict FDA guidance.
It's all about documentation, isn't it?
Yes. In pharma, it is all about validation. You have to prove the machine works through this insane level of documentation. You have IQ, or installation qualification, which proves you simply assembled and bolted it down correctly, according to the manual.
Just to prove you put it together right.
Right. Then there's OQ, operational qualification, proving it runs as designed. And finally, PQ, performance qualification, proving it manufactures the medicine perfectly every single time.
And the sources note that in pharma, if you make a tiny design tweak, say, moving a sensor bracket just 2 inches to the left, right, you invalidate all that testing.
Instantly. You trigger a massive regulatory headache because you have to reprove the entire machine from scratch.
That sounds like a nightmare. So reading through these wildly different requirements, I honestly found myself asking, if engineers are so brilliant, why not just design one ultimate machine?
One machine to rule them all.
Yeah. Why not build a hyper-sanitary, armor-plated, perfectly precise robot and just use it for everything? Food, mining, pharma, all of it.
Because the concept of the best machine design is a total myth. In industrial engineering, overbuilding is just another form of failure.
Wait, really? How is making it better a failure?
Think about the physics and the economics. If you build a clean room grade stainless steel machine with extreme robotic precision just to, like, fold cardboard boxes in a dry, dusty packaging plant, you have failed.
Oh, because of the cost.
Exactly. That machine will be vastly too heavy, consume way too much electricity, and cost 10 times more than the customer can actually afford. Application fit is the only true metric of success.
But designing the perfect custom-built machine for a specific application hits a massive wall when you look at the factory floor today.
Oh, yes. The landscape is shifting.
Right. You can't just throw unlimited money and labor at building these machines anymore because the macroeconomic landscape has completely fractured. The sources describe the 2025 and 2026 environment as basically a perfect storm.
It is a profound shift. Machine builders are simultaneously navigating severe, skilled labor shortages, aggressive new expectations for energy efficiency, and intense cybersecurity demands.
They want the machine to do more.
Much more. Buyers do not just want a machine that physically stamps metal anymore. They require a machine that actually absorbs those macroeconomic pressures for them.
Right. And that leads us to the rise of Industry 4.0 and smart machinery. The sources mention these machines now have to talk to the factory's larger MES and SCADA networks. Let's decode those acronyms for a second.
Sure. So MES stands for Manufacturing Execution System. Think of it as the digital floor manager. It tracks exactly what needs to be produced and when.
Okay. And SCADA.
SCADA stands for Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition. It's the system gathering all the real-time performance data from every single sensor in the building. So a modern machine cannot be an island anymore. It has to constantly report its health and throughput back to that central manager.
And it has to do it while using less power. We're seeing standards like ISO 50001 pushing energy efficiency as a core design requirement, not just an afterthought.
Which completely changes how you build the power systems.
Exactly. The International Energy Agency specifically highlights the adoption of variable speed drives. Explain how that actually saves energy in the mechanical design.
So historically, a machine's electric motor might just run at 100% power constantly,
yeah,
right? And the machine would use mechanical brakes to literally fight the motor and slow down the movement, which obviously wastes massive amounts of energy as heat.
Like driving with your foot on the gas and the brake at the same time?
Perfect analogy. A variable speed drive electronically reduces the power fed to the motor exactly when less force is needed. It matches energy consumption to the immediate mechanical demand rather than fighting against itself.
That makes so much sense. And then there's the labor shortage, which is driving this huge explosion in cobot integration, like, you know, collaborative robots designed to work right next to human beings.
They're everywhere now.
They really are. According to the International Federation of Robotics, cobots hit a 10.5% share of robot installations back in 2023, and the industry is projecting 542,000 total robotic installations in 2024.
It's scaling incredibly fast.
But integrating a cobot changes the engineering entirely, right? Because you have to design force-limiting sensors, adjust the operational envelope, add vision systems so the machine constantly knows where the human's hands are.
Precisely. The human basically becomes a dynamic variable in the machine's control logic. And to deal with all this rapid, complex change, designers are heavily favoring modularity.
Yes, modularity. When I read about modularity, my mind instantly went to industrial Legos.
That's a good way to picture it.
Instead of building one massive custom machine that only makes one specific size of a shampoo bottle, you build a base platform and just snap on swappable modules when you need to make a different bottle.
The Lego idea works conceptually, but the reality is infinitely more complex. You can't just snap a physical module onto a machine. The control software has to instantly recognize, authenticate, and integrate the new hardware without someone rewriting the code.
Oh, like plug and play for heavy machinery.
Exactly. There is an ongoing debate right now between fixed purpose and modular architecture. A fixed purpose machine will almost always win on raw, blistering speed.
Because it only does one thing.
Right. But modularity is winning the market today because consumer demand shifts so rapidly. When a packaging size changes, you don't scrap a $1 million machine, you just swap a module. It protects the factory's capital investment.
But to build these adaptable modular systems fast enough, an engineer really can't afford to build a physical prototype, find a structural flaw, and start all over. The timeline is just too tight.
Way too tight.
So they are turning to virtual steel, digital twins.
Digital twins are, well, they're revolutionary. Siemens defines them as highly accurate virtual replicas used for monitoring and validation before a single piece of steel is ever cut.
And it's not just a 3D drawing, right?
Not at all. Engineers run the actual control code on the virtual machine to test its kinematics.
Yep.
You know, how the arms and gears physically interact, and they even simulate how thermal heat builds up in the enclosures under stress.
It creates this continuous digital thread. I really want to trace this out because it's fascinating. It starts with CAD computer-aided design, which maps the geometry.
Right, the basic shapes.
Then that feeds into simulation software for the FEA stress testing we talked about, which then feeds directly into CAM computer-aided manufacturing, which literally writes the tool paths for the robots that will cut the metal.
Yes.
And it's all locked down by PLM.
Yes, product lifecycle management. Yeah. PLM is basically the master vault. If an engineer in Germany updates a mounting bracket in the CAD file to make it stronger, the CAM software in Ohio immediately knows not to mill the old version.
That's amazing.
It is. PLM prevents catastrophic version mismatches across global teams.
And this digital foresight is absolutely crucial for safety and compliance. You've got things like ISO 12100 for risk assessments and ISO 13849-1 for control systems, not to mention ASME and OSHA standards. But wait, I need to stop you on the safety design step.
Sure, what's up?
When I walk through a modern factory, a lot of the safety stuff just looks like yellow metal cages bolted to the floor around the dangerous spinning parts. Why does a metal fence need to be engineered into the conceptual architecture from day one?
Because retrofitting a safety cage, as an afterthought, completely ruins the machine.
Mm.
If you just bolt a fence around a finished design, you suddenly block the operator's line of sight.
Oh, I didn't think about that.
Right. You obstruct the safety sensors. You make maintenance access a total nightmare, which drastically increases downtime during repairs. True safety integrated guarding, light curtains, emergency stops, has to be woven into the geometry of the machine from the very beginning.
And the regulatory pressure is just mounting. The sources highlight that the European Union is shifting from their old machinery directive to a much stricter regulation, EU 2023-1230, which was into full effect on January 20, 2027.
And that impending regulation is changing engineering strategy right now, today. It places a heavy emphasis on the safety of software and artificial intelligence.
So you have to prove the code is safe.
Exactly. Engineers have to use their digital twins right now to simulate how their control algorithms will behave under failure conditions, just to prove compliance before 2027 even arrives.
But while we're talking about safety, physical guarding only protects against physical threats. The Society of Manufacturing Engineers, the SME, highlights a modern, invisible threat that is deeply concerning. Cybersecurity.
It is a highly critical vulnerability. The SME warns that the manufacturing sector has been dangerously late to adopt cybersecurity safeguards.
Because they used to be isolated machines.
Right. But because these new smart machines are constantly connected to MES and SCADA networks to transmit data, their attack surface is enormous. A compromised industrial machine isn't just a data breach. It is a massive, heavy, moving piece of steel that can be maliciously manipulated.
That is terrifying.
It really is. Designing a machine today requires robust network security architecture just as much as it requires strong physical welds.
That is genuinely chilling. A hacker literally weaponizing a factory line. Which I guess brings us from defending against algorithms to actually collaborating with them. Here's where it gets really interesting.
We're looking at the future now.
Exactly. If digital tools and smart connectivity are the present, what happens when we give these tools the power to actually design the machines alongside us?
We are fully entering the era of generative design. Engineers using platforms like Autodesk or Siemens NX are no longer just, you know, drawing the parts themselves.
So what are they doing?
Instead, they feed the constraints into the AI, defining the mounting points, the maximum size, and the dynamic forces acting on the part. The AI then runs thousands of simulations, systematically stripping away any microscopic voxel of material that isn't actively carrying a load.
And the shapes the AI produces are just wild. They don't look like traditional blocky machined metal. They look organic.
Like alien metallic bones.
Yes. Because the AI doesn't care about what's easy for a human to draw. It only cares about where the stress flows. These parts use vastly less material, they're significantly lighter, yet they're actually stronger.
And because of their complex geometry, they're often built using additive manufacturing, basically industrial 3D printing.
It is a complete paradigm shift in structural logic, and we are seeing similar leaps in powertrains too. For heavy-duty, off-highway equipment where traditional lithium batteries are simply too heavy and lack the energy density to be practical, companies like Volvo Group and Cummins are aggressively advancing green hydrogen combustion and fuel cells.
Which solves the heavy payload problem without the emissions.
Exactly. We're also seeing autonomy pushing deep into mining equipment, removing humans from the most dangerous environments entirely. And for the humans still working on these machines, the human-machine interface is evolving fast. The World Economic Forum highlights how augmented reality is being used to accelerate training.
AR is a game changer for maintenance.
Seriously, imagine a maintenance worker wearing AR goggles. They look at a broken pump, and the goggles project the digital twin directly over the physical machine, highlighting exactly which bolts to turn and in what order in real time.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, what we are witnessing is the center of gravity permanently shifting in the industrial world.
Oh, so?
It has moved from static, isolated hardware to highly connected adaptive systems.
Right.
The primary constraint in this industry is no longer the technology itself. The true constraint is human capital.
Finding the right people.
Yes. It is finding the rare engineers who can simultaneously understand mechanical stress, advanced control logic, data architectures, and real-world service strategy all at once.
It really requires an entirely new breed of thinker to build this world. So let's recap this incredible journey. We started with the brutal physics of dynamic fatigue, explored how environments like pharma and mining demand completely different architectures, and traced the digital thread from virtual twins and strict safety regulations all the way to generative AI designing alien-looking parts for a $117 billion industry. So what does this all mean for you?
That's a lot to take in.
It is. Well, consider this final thought to mull over. If digital twins are constantly running virtual simulations of a machine's wear and tear in real time, and AI is already designing optimal replacement parts, how long before an industrial machine can accurately predict its own obsolescence?
That's a profound thought.
Imagine a world where a stamping press knows its own main bearing is going to fail in exactly 3 weeks. So without human intervention, it autonomously uses generative AI to design an upgraded, structurally superior version of that bearing and sends the file to an industrial 3D printer. The newly optimized part is printed and waiting on the factory floor before the manager even realizes the original machine was starting to fail. The next time you pick up a manufactured object, don't just look at the finished product. Think about the invisible, intelligent, mechanical giants that made it and the brilliant minds balancing physics, context, and code to bring them to life. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.